Hi, I'm Troy Bronsink, and this is From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Each episode has two parts, a conversation and a guided meditation. We're connecting you to a variety of contemplative teachers, hearing their story, as well as sharing a meditative practice. If you don't have time now to hear their story, take a look at the show notes for when the meditation portion begins, and feel free to skip ahead and come back later to the conversation. Today's conversation is with Science Mike, or Mike McCarg. He's the best-selling author of Finding God in the Waves, host of Ask Science Mike, and co-host of the Liturgist podcast. He hits that sweet spot between science and religion. And before you say what sweet spot, I encourage you just to listen in on how he weaves together his fundamentalist Christian upbringing and what he now calls mystical empiricism. Now, you could be doing a million different things right now. You might be putting together an IKEA piece of furniture or mopping the floor. That said, why don't you just take a break and look around you, take a couple deep breaths, and enjoy listening in. Hopefully, you'll be able to sit and meditate with us in the second half as well. Well, it's a pleasure to have Mike McCarg with us today. Thanks for being with us, Mike.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, you're the author of Finding God in the Waves, How I Lost My Faith and Found It Again Through Science. I think we met a couple years ago at the Wild Goose Festival. But first, I just would like to just hear a little bit about how recently has the book come out? What's your process of kind of getting out and sharing the story of this work you do?
Well, the book came out September 13th, and I've scarcely been home since. I've been on a tour all over the country, going city to city, doing little talks and Q&As about the book. It's been going incredibly well. I'm a first-time author, so I didn't know what to expect, mm-hmm. and I've been really blown away by how many people have read the book and how it's affected them. Including the fact that there is a chapter on the neuroscience of prayer and meditation, including some sample exercises and practice. So even though the book is kind of delivered via a narrative, almost a memoir, mm-hmm. the memoir is just a delivery mechanism for everyday practice of faith and the science behind it.
Yeah.
And perfect. So throughout the book, I have kind of prescriptive, recommendations and practices for people who want to try to foster a faith that haven't had one before, or deepen a faith if they find themselves in a period of doubt.
Yeah, well, that's good. When we were going to have this call a week ago, the day after the election, and when we were working through some technical things and talking about it, there was kind of this aha of the whole nation being in a place where the amygdala is kind of our primary way of surviving that surprise, or the different ways that we kind of engaged that new news on Wednesday morning. I think you do such a good job of describing this relationship between what kind of the neuroscience of how our brain engages. I love the stories that you're telling at the beginning about the walk through your relationship to your dad, the walk through that relationship of kind of like how we self-justify ourselves, and then how that moves into that understanding of God, and reading Dawkins. And I think it was a Sagan movie that kind of began to really pull the bottom out for you. Would you say a little bit about that?
Sure. I read pretty much every book by every major skeptic during that period of my life, and none of them, they certainly altered my theology in many cases, but they didn't eliminate my faith. But it was reading Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot that finally, I think, broke my faith completely. And it was just Carl Sagan's exploration of the idea of geocentrism, that the earth is somehow special or remarkable in the cosmos. And that's a notion that's pretty rapidly dispelled with with space probes and telescopes. And that made me feel small and foolish mm-hmm. for believing that God would create the universe for humanity. And it was that idea and the contemplation of that idea that finally led me out of faith and into atheism.
Mm-hmm. And what was that? How would you describe where you situate yourself now then, within that atheism and that kind of no man's land, and yet your intentional practices?
Theologically, I would probably call myself a non-theist.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm certainly not an atheist anymore, but I don't go to the point of theism where I make a lot of definitive claims about God. Sort of in how I relate to the universe, I'd call myself an empiricist.
Mm-hmm.
But how I relate to God, I would call myself a mystic.
Let's play with that for a little bit. So I think some of the cleverness of the way that you put all this inside of your own personal story, but then the transparency and openness of the empiricist that's kind of going like, meanwhile, here's how you can read this from a scientific objective point, and I understand this is kind of crazy. So mystic and empiricist, how do you put those together?
I think one demands the other.
Hmm.
I think that empiricism demands, if you're going to have a faith, it must be mystical.
Nice.
And, the thing about science, the thing about empiricism, it never proves anything with 100% certainty. All knowledge is provisional in empiricism. Now, you get to very high degrees of confidence because you have a lot of evidence to support a given idea. But the confidence is never absolute. And that's a really good way to learn about the physical world and learn about reality and learn about our universe. But when you study religious faith empirically,
mm-hmm.
you find that some of the most treasured assumptions of skeptics who are antagonistic towards faith are not really scientific claims. They're overblown rhetoric. The idea that religion is unhealthy for people doesn't have a good grounding in among people who study that. The idea that religion is harmful for society as a blanket statement is also not well supported by sociologists. So the skeptics may have a great argument against particular types of authoritarian
Mm-hmm.
or fear and anger-based religious expression, but it's an oversimplification to say that that represents all religious faith and practice, and it's definitely an oversimplification and possibly a falsehood to say that people who have a love-focused, non-authoritarian faith act as enablers for the rest of the bunch.
Yeah.
Some of the people who most vigorously oppose the abuse of religious practice and power structures tend to be people who have a more grounded faith.
Mm-hmm.
And amidst all that, the thing that leads me to mysticism is a field of study called neurotheology. And that's not a study of God. It's a study of what beliefs about God do to the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
And universally, people who do this kind of work have found that our neurological relationship to God is not linguistic or rational in nature, that our experience with God and our knowledge of God looks more like a feeling or an experience in the brain than a set of ideas. And when people know God or experience God and you ask them to describe it, there's a delay as their left temporal lobe, which is uh-huh. the part of the brain that articulates language, analyzes the brain state, and tries to put it into words. And that process modifies the original brain statement.
So several
neuroscientists say that mysticism is therefore the most authentic expression of faith, because mystics refuse to try to put everything they experience or know about God into language, that they simply sit with it. And my empiricism tells me that's a very honest way to relate to God.
To sit with something without putting language to it being an honest practice.
Yes.
Yeah. So let me ask you a couple, let me throw a couple anecdotes out and ask you to kind of talk me through the way that, like the neurological journey that's going on with this. The first is, just in our conversation when we got on the phone, last week, you shared that you've had a consistent practice. I don't know how many years it was, but a consistent practice that's been daily. And the challenge for your mind, and I could relate to this entirely, and we have talked to a lot of folks about it in the week to follow, but the challenge of really being able to center and open back up to that meditation on a loving God or whatever that would look like. Say a little bit about that experience, if you would, but then also kind of, why do you think that happened? Why did our bodies chemically respond that way?
Oh, that's a really beautiful question. I mean, in my, I was unable to complete my morning meditation November the 9th, which has never happened to me since I started meditating. but I felt so much anxiety and anxiousness. I wasn't able to quiet my mind. And that's not necessarily a sign that you're failing a meditation. the only sign of failing a meditation is you believe you failed it. But it just seemed like a total loss to me. So like 6 minutes in, I got up and left my practice.
Yeah.
And it was several days before. So what, I'm maybe on the third day now where I've been able to meditate normally again. And that makes a lot of sense neurologically. So if you label yourself as progressive or liberal or Democrat or any combination of those terms, you probably have a statistically more diverse social network than your friends who would identify themselves as conservative or Republican.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that means the signals that are coming into your life from friends or social media embody a state of panic, and you're a social mammal. Mm-hmm. And if your community is under attack, you are too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I happen to be of the mindset that if you are a person of color in this country, or you are LGBTQ, or in a traditionally marginalized group, you may actually be in an increased state of danger right now compared to before this election, either because of policies that will be coming next year, or because a larger than we thought fringe of white nationalists has been energized by this victory.
Right.
But we respond to that by having very elevated levels of amygdala activity in our brain versus other parts of our brain, by releasing cortisol and lots of shots of adrenaline into our bloodstream. We go into a persistent state of either fight or flight, or we're in a grief cycle, and all those things impair our executive function through the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is essential in your meditative practice. So these kinds of signals that are sending that basically say it's not safe to sit, it's not safe to be still.
Right, right.
You know, you could imagine an animal literally pacing in a circle. We just do it in our mind.
That's right.
And that those times are actually when meditating is the most important.
And so you're taking this risk, like your prefrontal cortex makes a decision to say to your amygdala, it doesn't make sense, I know, but I'm going to still hold space for this alternative. Would that be a way of describing it?
Yeah, well, I think in my case, I just allowed myself to grieve.
Mm-hmm.
And I had conversations with friends to process and unpack my feelings. And it wasn't that I suddenly had enough willpower. Mm-hmm. It's that meditation does not exist in isolation. And when I realized that my grief was interfering with my practice, I focused instead on my grief to start to discharge that and allow me to recover my normal centered outlook.
That's really good.
And that's been, I've had a tremendous relief in the last few days. Circumstances haven't changed. You know, there's some political appointments that concern me more. And I don't want anyone hearing this to hear that I'm rushing you through your grief process.
There you go.
What I'm saying is actually focus on your grief process. And there's no timeline in which I would dictate is healthy or unhealthy.
But in
my case, I was able to get enough grief out to get back to a centered state that hopefully I can have the attention to make appropriate reactions and counteractions to what may be happening in the next 2 to 4 years.
Oh, this is really great. You talk about appropriate actions and reactions. There were two different folks I met with in the last week who really wanted to hold boundaries when it came to that grieving. One, I met with her, a leader, person of color, and when we met, she was like, we're going to meet about this in this place. I'm not going to talk right now about what else is going on. And it was really through the process of our lunch and the opening to the grief that then allowed, or at least me opening about my own grief, that then allowed some space for her to kind of meet me eye to eye. And again, it wasn't rushing like you were saying, but it was just permission granting, I think. But we are taking it at different paces. And then we do a bunch of different classes at the Hive. And just last night, for the first time, one of the processes we were doing around non-dual contemplation, and one woman was just needed to say, I'm not ready to hold the whole picture yet. I'm incredibly sad and I need to leave. And for the group to be able to honor that, and just know this stuff takes work and time to work through, is pretty powerful. So when you said it wasn't your ego or willpower to create the space, I think that's pretty interesting. We're going to take a break in a second here to invite you to kind of guide us through one of your own meditative practices. But I'm curious, there's one more question I wanted to ask you. I have a number of friends that are folks on the road who are musicians that travel. And some of them have taken up a centering prayer practice and yet have really struggled with the rhythm of doing that when you're on the road or sleeping in a van or those sort of things. How have you been able to maintain a practice as a traveling musician and author now and in that sort of work? What are the different tricks of the trade?
Well, you want to start by building a meditation base camp when you're not on the road.
Okay.
So the best time to get started with practice is when you're in a familiar environment, and you have a little more control over your scheduling. But as you meditate more often, you train your brain to get into a meditative space more rapidly. And so at this point in my life, to meditate in 24C on the airplane or in a hotel room or in the back seat of a van, wherever I find myself, I can do a 5-minute, a 15-minute, a 30-minute meditation, and it's not difficult anymore. But that's I'm reaping dividends of time investment when my schedule is more stable. You could probably start a practice during a busy travel season. It's going to take extra intent, and you're going to have to be extra patient with yourself because that's an increased degree of difficulty. You know, it's like trying to run a 5K wearing a backpack full of, heavy things. You can do it, but it's going to be more difficult. And if you started your practice of running, wearing weights, you're not going to advance as quickly as someone in an easier environment. People have such fundamental misconceptions about what meditation is. And what we're talking about is a time of intentional awareness. That's all it is. So you can create the chaos and distraction of your environment and incorporate it as part of your practice, because you're just making a choice about where you place your attention. And when the, you know, the bass player, you know, makes a joke or whatever, and the whole van starts laughing, and your attention is pulled out of your center into that space, you simply return your attention gently back to the original point of focus. And it's not like your meditation is over or failed or anything like that. You just got to have the right expectations with your practice. And, you know, consistency is a little harder. My schedule on tour, I don't have a normal daily rhythm. It depends on what time of day the event is and what the travel day looks like. So I don't have my usual time of day grounding that I have when I'm at home. This morning, I got up much later than usual, and I haven't meditated yet today. So I'm going to do that after this call. So you give yourself some grace in terms of scheduling when your schedule is chaotic. I flew across the country yesterday and got home late. But it's just a matter of making sure you get in your time. And if you're new to meditation, your travel meditation schedule may look like 5 minutes a day. That's okay.
Right.
That's okay. That's still deepening your practice.
Well, that's great. Thank you. Mike McHarg will come back in a moment and invite you to actually guide us in one of those practices. So thanks a lot. We'll be right back.
Hey there, you've been listening to From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. I'm your host, Troy Bronsink, founder and director of The Hive, a center for contemplation, art, and action. This episode is part of a 5-episode mini-season, and if you have any recommendations or if you're interested in advertising, you can email me at troy@cincyhive.org. Now, The Hive is a nonprofit located in the North Side neighborhood of Cincinnati. Our secret sauce is outfitting people to take up a daily practice through this 6 to 8 week peer-to-peer groups or through events with luminaries in the arts and in community and yoga and spirituality and more. You can check out our website at cincyhive.org for more info on how to get involved.
Hi, we're back with Mike McHarg here at The Hive talking about the work of practice and the neurotheological lens of looking at how practicing and meditating on a loving God reaps dividends in your relationship to your work and life and a number of those things. Mike, when we were just finishing, we were talking about the challenge of practice and taking a practice on the road and a number of those things. What I'd like to do now is just invite you to kind of guide us in a practice, and maybe first you'd want to give a little bit of a framework as to meeting people where they are. So like how they might kind of be pay attention to the room they're in and those things, and tell us a little bit about the space you're in, and then kind of guide us into that time for the upcoming 10 to 15 minutes, if you would.
Okay. Well, we're simply going to do a basic centering prayer. And if you're new to meditation, the most important thing you can do now is not judge yourself. There is no way to fail or do this incorrectly. The most important component of meditation is a non-judgmental posture. So I'm in my office in Tallahassee, Florida. The sunlight is coming in through a big window in front of me. My desk is cluttered and messy because I'm not home long enough to clean it these days. And I have an awareness that I would like to rectify that. But for now, I'm just going to acknowledge and release that. We begin to observe ourselves in our practice. Now, if you're new to meditation, I can show you what that means. It means to be aware in a moment of what you were unaware of a moment ago. And right now, as I say this, you can become aware, for example, that you blink. You've been listening to this conversation and you are completely unaware that you blink, but now every time you blink, you're aware of it And it, once you become aware that you blink, you may start to try to control that. You may blink more or less often. And in the type of meditation we're about to do, you would not control your blinking. You would merely be aware of it. So our centering for this meditation will begin with our breath. And that means it's important to be aware of our breath, but not try to control it. So I'd like you to begin, if you may, by turning your phone on airplane mode or do not disturb, because is one of the most successful ways to add difficulty to your practice. And we want to have a nice, easy time of practice this morning. So after you've told your phone to leave you alone for the next few minutes, find a comfortable posture, preferably sitting if you are able. You may be tempted to lie down. There's nothing wrong with lying down. But if you don't get enough sleep, you may find that your time of meditation turns into a nap if you lie down. So find a comfortable posture. I like to sit straight up with my back straight. I like to place my hands on my thighs, palm up, which creates a receptive posture. And then for a moment, with your eyes open, look around the room. What's the lighting like? What textures do you see? Maybe you're on a crowded subway. What do you see? And in that silence, what do you hear now that you did not a moment ago? I hear the whir of my computer's fan, the quiet click of a hard drive. What do you hear in your space? Now close your eyes. What do you feel? Can you feel the weight of your body against the chair? Where do you feel weight and heaviness? Where do you feel tension? Are you hot or cold? Are different parts of your body hot or cold? Where can you feel the movement of the air against your skin? Take a moment to explore the sensations that you have through your body. Now become aware of your breath. Every inhale, every exhale. Feel the coolness of the air as it enters your body. And the warmth as it's released. Focus on each breath. And as you do this, you may find that suddenly your skin is itchy. You may find that suddenly you remember the bills due next Tuesday or the meeting this afternoon. We're so busy, and your mind and body are unaccustomed to stillness. So when the meeting pops into your mind, greet it and let it pass. If fear or anxiety begin to well up inside of you. Simply be aware of that. And then gently return your attention to your breath. Every breath is a sustaining gift. You don't have to do anything to breathe. Your body executes this miracle on its own. Neither do you have to collect or hoard oxygen. It's just freely available all around you. And so as we focus on our breath, we become aware of its gift, that our lives are freely sustained by a good God. Take a few moments and be aware of that gift. And every time you exhale, you release carbon dioxide, a substance which is dangerous for your body. You release a poison with your breath, and without any effort, the world receives and processes it. You don't have to do anything. Our life is centered on a cycle of breathing in a gift and exhaling that which we no longer need and might even harm us. So as you focus on your breath, imagine that every time you inhale, you're breathing in love and grace from God. And every time you exhale, you're releasing fear, anxiety, and anger. With each breath, feel renewed and relaxed. And every time you exhale, release muscle tension from your body and let go of emotional wounds. Take a few moments to receive a good gift and release those things which make you afraid or angry. Now begin to return your attention to the sensations of your body and the sounds that surround you. Let your attention drift away from your breath and into the outside world. You are part of a larger world. You are part of a society and a culture. And you receive love and grace freely from your breath. And now imagine how you may return love and grace to the space you are in now and the people that you encounter. Open your eyes. Look around the room. Experience gratitude and grace for the light that allows you to see and for the space you have to practice. And for as long as you are able, maintain an awareness of the gift that is your awareness.
Well, thanks, Mike. I'm grateful for you making space with us, for being here, and thankful for a gift to share with a wider community about the depth of starting and sustaining a practice like this. Thankful for the work you're doing, helping articulate that in that brilliant ways, and in kind of the transparency and vulnerable self-disclosure that's part of the story as well. If you want to hear more about Mike McHarg's work, there are a number of different outlets. What are some of the ways we could stay in touch with you, Mike?
You can learn all about my take on meditation in my new book, Finding God in the Waves, which you can learn more about findinggodinthewaves.com. And I host a weekly podcast that's a question and answer centered called Ask Science Mike, which you can learn about on AskScienceMike.com, which will also give you links to my social media and the other podcast I'm a part of called The Liturgist Podcast.
Mike, it's a pleasure to have spent some time with you. Look forward to being face-to-face in the same room sometime again, and wish you the best as you tour the book and a number of other ways you kind of continue to open our eyes to the significance of practice and really help us all make space for being present and aware. And wish you the best on the week and months ahead.
Well, thank you. This was definitely the most restorative conversation I've had in this format. So
that's
thanks
cool.
for creating the space this morning.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
I'm Troy Bronsink, and this has been From the Hive, a contemplative space where meditative practice meets mindful everyday living. Today, we've been talking with Mike McHarg. You can check out the show notes for ways to connect with his work. Come back next week when we'll do some meditation straight from the hive.